morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Wade against the Soo Line. Mr. Bruges.
Good morning, judges. My name is George Bruges, and this is the FALA case involving Rule 37 sanctions that were imposed against my client, Mike Wade, and myself. Rule 37, the Hensley case and the Devine case, and Judge Zagel's second order, his order of September 27th.
Bruges, I wonder why you are here. You're still representing Wade, I gather.
He has another attorney, Your Honor.
Not on the briefs.
We're here to...
Let me make it clear why I'm asking this question. I do not understand how you can file an appeal, the result of which is to shift a very large monetary obligation to your client, off of your shoulders and onto your client's. It looks to me like you have an irreconcilable conflict of interest with Wade.
Well, actually, what would happen, Your Honor, is that if it was shifted to Wade, then it would be an insurable cost.
It doesn't matter whether it's going to be paid by somebody else. You are taking a position materially adverse to your client. Has your client consented to bearing this obligation personally in order to relieve you?
No, Your Honor.
Well, I don't understand. I tried to check about how things stand in Illinois, and we found some lawyers who have been disbarred for doing what you're doing now.
I don't think that he would ever bear the cost of this sanction, Your Honor, because it would either, as Judge Zagel said, it ultimately is my responsibility. And I mean, to the extent that it's affirmed, I accept that responsibility, and we have posted a letter of credit to protect that judgment.
Yes, and you're asking that the judgment be reversed and the sanction be shifted to your client. Off of you and onto your client. If, as you now say, it doesn't make any difference, then I don't understand why you're appealing. The only reason for an appeal is that it does make a difference, and the difference is that you're asking us to order your client personally to pay the money off of your shoulders and onto his.
Judge, I would then respectfully withdraw that argument because that was not the intent of our brief, and that's not the intent of our argument. The intent of our argument is that Rule 37 does not provide for the sanction that Judge Zagel ordered in this case.
I understand that that's your reason for asking that it be moved to your client, but that still is an irreconcilable conflict.
Well, again, I would make an oral motion, if I may, to withdraw that portion of my brief that says that this should be moved to Wade. I withdraw that. I do not ask that it be moved to Wade, and I don't think that would be an appropriate result in this case. I've never said that in my brief.
What is your position then? Is it that it shouldn't have been any sanction at all, or the sanction is too much?
Yes, Your Honor. There is two really rather minor violations of Rule 26, and what all the cases say and what Rule 37 says is that when there is a violation of Rule 26 and a sanction under Rule 37, then the attorney's fees that are awarded should be commensurate, or must be there must be a proof that the attorney's fees are caused by the violation. And there was no proof in this case, either in the court below or in the briefs here, that any attorney's fees were caused by the violations that Judge Zagel found. So, and Judge Zagel recognized that in his second order. He said that, gave the railroad an opportunity to file additional briefing in order for them to establish what attorney's fees were caused by these two really de minimis violations of Rule 26. And they never have presented any attorney's fees that were caused.
Awfully hard to describe this as a de minimis violation. The district court essentially found that this case is a result of fraud, that you well knew that your client was not injured in the way he described and then hid the evidence showing that. That's what Judge Zagel found. Now, maybe wrongly, I understand the basis of your appeal, but it's very difficult to say that this is a de minimis violation. Judge Zagel was incensed
Judge Zagel thought this was a workers' compensation case. In a workers' compensation case, and he's, I mean, the very first words in the very first opinion he wrote was that this is a workers' compensation case. In a workers' compensation case under Illinois law, in order to get an award for permanent partial disability, you have to have a doctor's report that says this man has a permanent injury. He thought that Judge Dr. Treister's report that said there's no permanent injury here was issued dispositive of the FELA case, and it's not. Under a FELA case, if a person has...
I can understand the argument that Judge Zagel was mistaken. The thing I was now questioning was the assertion that Judge Zagel thought this was de minimis. If Judge Zagel is right in understanding the problem here, this whole case is fraudulent. It should never have been brought, and you attempted in discovery to hide the fact that you knew it should never have been brought. Now, that may be wrong, as I say. I don't want to say that everything a district judge says is conclusively right, but saying it's all de minimis, so although there was a violation, the sanction should be low is very difficult. And you have not appealed from the finding that there was a discovery violation.
Here's you know, my position. There's two sets of documents here. There's Exhibit H and there's Exhibits F and G. Exhibit H is a report of an IME that was done 6 months after the plaintiff finished treating that said, yes, he was off work for a year, rightfully so, that he had been to Rush Press, been to Cook County, been to his treating doctor, and been to physical therapy. There was an independent radiologist at an MRI facility that found pathology in his shoulder. He had an injury. It's a Safety Appliance Act case. It's an absolute liability case against the railroad. Michael Wade was entitled to his wage loss for the year he was off work. He's entitled to pain and suffering and disability for that period of time. It's not a fraudulent case. It's a run-of-the-mill, pretty clear-cut FELA case where Michael Wade was entitled to compensation for his work-related injuries for the railroad's violation of the Safety Appliance Act. And what happened was is that he did not have a permanent injury, that he had bursitis, tendonitis in his shoulder that prevented him from doing the heavy work of a railroad switchman, and the doctor kept him off work for a year. There was never any claim made. Mike Wade testified in his deposition he had no permanent injury. The treating doctor, 6 months in July, 6 months before Dr. Treister's exam, released him to return to work with no restrictions and said he has no permanent disability. That was the case through the entire case, and that's why I say it's a de minimis violation, because Exhibit H said exactly what the treating doctor said. And the best proof of how meaningless Exhibit H is, the progress report, is Dan Mohan's own testimony at the hearing, where he said it has no opinions, it's a vanilla document, it doesn't help his case and doesn't hurt my case. And that was the railroad's lawyer's testimony about Dr. Treister's IME report during Judge Zagel's hearing. So one of the things that Rule 37 talks about is prejudice and harm. They have never claimed in the court below or in this court that not having Exhibit H from January of 2004 until December of 2004 caused them any harm or caused them any prejudice, because they knew exactly what Mike Wade's medical condition was.
We're not just limited to Exhibit H.
Now,
nor are we concerned only about the failure to disclose initially. We also have things like the mysterious disappearance after your adversary saw the file, clipped it to be photocopied, and all of a sudden it vanishes from the file. Now, a judge might conclude that something very nefarious is going on.
Yeah, but Judge Zagel said that that was Dr. Treister's office staff personnel, that I had nothing to do with that. I think if Judge Zagel thought I had something to do with that, he would have said that in his opinion. But that whole part of this, you know, he even a footnote in his first opinion, he attributes that to Dr. Treister's staff. What happened at that deposition was, at the end of the deposition, Dan Mohan said on the record at least four or five times that this is the document I'm looking for. It was in the file. It was copied and given to him. And he apologized on the record to the doctor for saying that he for his behavior and saying that the document was missing. When I left that deposition, it was my understanding that he had every document that he wanted. Now, the second class of documents other than Exhibit H are these two documents, F and G. They were faxed to me And Judge Zagel found the first time that I saw them was in January of 2004. January 4th of 2004, they were given to Dan Mohan 21 days later. I was involved in a jury trial in Cook County for 10 of those days. There's no attorney's fees associated with that 21 days. There's no prejudice. There's no harm that they have ever raised associated with that 21 days and not having those documents. So Exhibit H is a document that they knew about and has no new information on it. Exhibit F and G, they got 21 days after I received it. And that's why, they had every document that they needed prior to their filing any motion or taking any action in this case.
Just one other thing, is that's the $110,000 of attorney's fees. Now, that I assume is the whole case.
From beginning to end, yes.
And I think you were making some kind of an assertion that, if anything, it would only be from the 5th of January, 2005?
I said 2004, I mean 2005. That's what Judge Zagel put in second order. My assertion is that under the Illinois Supreme Court, your precedent, and Rule 37, that they have the burden of proving a causal connection between these two violations that Judge Zagel found and the attorney's fees that were incurred as a result of those violations, and they have never done that. They have never
If I recall correctly, Judge Zagel asked you to provide data on the attorney's fees from the time when these documents should have been turned over till the time when they were. Were those estimates provided?
He did not ask me for attorney's fees, Judge.
Pardon?
I don't believe he asked me. He gave the defendant, after the second order, an opportunity. He said in his second order in September 27, 2005, you're only entitled to the attorney's fees that are caused by the rule violations. He said that specifically. They never filed anything because, there are no attorney's fees associated with these two rule violations. Essentially is what, happened. There are none.
What went on after January 4th, 05? Nothing?
January 4th, 05, I was on trial. 21 days later.
No, I mean after that, and going through all this rigmarole after that, wasn't there a lot of other depositions?
Well, what happened was in February, they filed a motion that accused me of making payments under the table to Dr. Treister. That's claim one. And Judge Zagel had a four-day hearing on that issue because there was nothing else in issue. And Judge Zagel found that this more serious charge, claim one, it was not true. That we were able to establish, based upon Dr. Treister's billing, that every penny that he received was either for medical records, the IME, or from United Healthcare. So he found for us on the first claim, the more serious claim, and that's the way Judge Zagel termed it. The more serious claim is the accusation that there were some payments under the table, and it wasn't true, and there was no reason for the hearing, the four-day hearing, other than to establish whether or not this serious accusation of these payments, and it wasn't true. That's what I think, was the red flag in front of the bull in this case, was that there was accusations made that there was payments being made.
Let me come back to the question. Did you ever attempt to estimate for the district court the amount of the fees that would have been incurred after the time when these documents should have been disclosed? And that's before January. They were asked for in discovery and not turned over.
We did in our brief estimate that. We did not in front of
the... Did you ever provide an estimate to Judge Zagel? That's my question.
No. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schur.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honors have obviously read the briefs very closely, so I don't want to belabor everything that happened below. But as Your Honors indicated, there was a lot more to this than two minor violations of Rule 26. To sum up, what the district court found was that the very day this case was filed, Mr. Bruges had conversations with the doctor's office, the treating physician's office, in which an independent medical exam of his very witness was being discussed in a record review of somebody that had already been seeing for 10 months, which the trial court specifically found was an unsavory sweetening of the deal with the treating physician. Then when the progress note indicating there was nothing wrong with, nothing at all wrong with the plaintiff, and that there was no objective pathology indicating any treatment was necessary. And that was very different from the July return to work order, which was still ordering physical therapy because of the continuing problems. The progress note said there is no objective pathology requiring any treatment at this time that I can see. Mr. Bruges then did not turn that over. During the deposition, he said that it had been turned over and that Mr. Mohan would be quite embarrassed when he found that out. And then later, in response to the motion for sanctions, he took the position for the first time. I didn't turn it over, and I never had to turn it over because he was a consulting expert. The trial court found that under the facts of this case, after hearing the evidence, that there was no reasonable basis for Mr. Bruges to ever contend that he thought of Dr. Treister as his consulting expert. There was never a request to be a consulting expert. There was never any type of confidentiality agreement. And, in fact, the progress note that was issued was exactly the same as the other progress notes in the file. Mr. Bruges just did not turn it over because of what it said. Then, during the deposition, as Your Honors indicated,
what was being contested in this case at the time? Mr. Bruges just said that there is essentially 1 year's lost wages that were never contested. Is that accurate?
Well, I think, Your Honor, what really happened here, and the discovery was showing this, the injury occurred, the alleged injury occurred in June of 2002. Mr. Wade went right back to work. He wasn't off at all. About 10 days later, and there is some background facts in terms of disciplinary proceedings that were pending against Mr. Wade that were never part of this sanctions record, but certainly would have been part of a trial. In any event, Mr. Wade did not go to see anybody for 10 days. He went to go see his own doctor. His own doctor indicated that there was a shoulder sprain and returned him to work within a few days. 2 months later, after he did not go back to work, he was referred to Dr. Treister's office in August of 2002.
His physician returned him to work. Did he go back to work or not?
I apologize, Your Honor.
The physician released him. Counsel, only one of us can talk at a time. It sounds like somebody came in a cart and picked him up and dropped him off at his employer. What did he actually do?
He did not return to work.
What did the physician do?
The physician, which was Dr. Cordova, released him to return to work. He said that there was no problem to prevent him from working. I apologize.
He did not then go back to work?
No, he was returned to work by his own physician, but he did not go back to work.
You don't want to use the phrase "returned to work by a physician."
He was released to work.
He was released to work by a physician.
He gave an opinion saying he was capable of working.
That's right, Your Honor. Excuse me. In any event, 2 months later, the plaintiff was then referred to Dr. Treister's office.
By whom?
Well, in the documents that were produced during discovery, it was referred by a friend. Some of the documents that were found at the deposition said referred by plaintiff's attorney, which was some of the other problem that happened during this deposition. In any event...
You mean the record is unclear as to who referred him?
Well, the record isn't unclear at this point because Mr. Bruges did testify that he did get the name of Dr. Treister's office from somebody in his office, and it was referred by plaintiff's attorney's office. But that was not clear when the documents were produced in response to the subpoena.
I'm baffled now. I think I have two different answers. Does the record show that he was referred by his lawyer or by a friend?
But that's the reason for your confusion, Your Honor, is because there were two different records. There was a record that were originally produced that said referred by a friend, and that's what was produced in response to Mr. Mohan's subpoena. However, when Mr. Mohan asked to see the file during the doctor's deposition, there were documents in there indicating that Mr. Wade had been referred to the doctor's office by plaintiff's attorney.
In other words, the suggestion, not to put too fine a point upon it, was that the original responses to the discovery requests were fraudulent.
Exactly. Now, in any event, when the smoking gun, what the trial court referred to as the smoking guns were found at the depositions, which were, again, Exhibits F, G, and H. Those the file came back in, and at first, Mr. Mohan didn't find F, G, or H. And he went through, and he did not find F, G, or H. There was then a discussion between counsel, and Mr. Mohan was obviously very upset. Mr. Bruges, who had admitted that he reviewed those documents, and I don't think any attorney could have reviewed those documents and not realized that they were, as the trial court found, smoking guns, that he assumed that Mr. Mohan was only looking for the progress note of Exhibit, which was Exhibit H. And Exhibit H, since it was part of the patient's chart, was ultimately found in the file at the very end of the deposition. Mr. Bruges said that Mr. Mohan said, oh, that's all I was looking for, I apologize. That is absolutely not true. As Mr. Mohan testified, he was given that document at the very end of the deposition. In fact, after the deposition had terminated and they went back on the record to submit that as the last exhibit to the record. Mr. Mohan never said, that's all I was looking for, thank you. The trial court listened to the entire deposition transcript, which was on tape. The trial court read the deposition, and that was just not true to say that Mr. Mohan was only looking for Exhibit H, and he apologized at the end of the deposition. And in fact, when he got back to his office, saw that Exhibits F and H were still missing, that's when he prepared subpoenas for the very next day that went out to the doctor's office. Those subpoenas were delivered up there, and the doctor's office, instead of submitting the smoking guns to Mr. Mohan in response to the subpoenas, submitted the smoking guns to Mr. Bruges, along with the subpoenas, on January 4th, 2005. So now Mr. Bruges has those documents in his hand, and what does he do? Does he turn them over? No. He sends Mr. Mohan an attacking letter describing his erratic behavior, and he's not to set foot in the doctor's office again. And he's holding Exhibits F and G, which the doctor's office knew full well what was being looked for in response to those subpoenas. This was the evidence that the trial court heard. And by the way, the last piece of it was that at the hearing, Mr. Bruges testified, well, I was so busy preparing for trial, I never looked at the subpoena and the documents, Exhibits F and G. And the trial court said that testimony was utterly unconvincing. In other words, that testimony wasn't true at all. So, to sum up,
I think the correct word is perjury.
I think that's the correct word, too, Your Honor. So to sum up, the trial court looked at all these facts. An unsavory sweetening of a deal, a progress note that was hidden, lying at the hearing, not turning over smoking guns and yet attacking Mr. Mohan in a letter. That was the record that was before this court. Now, Your Honor's asked, did Mr. Bruges ever indicate what fees were after January 2005. First of all, I'd like to point out to the court that the fee petition that was filed by defendants in this case included a detailed description of every task that was done, including dates. That was already part of the record. What happened was that the judge said, submit a fee petition for all your fees, and that's exactly what was done. Then the court entered its second order. And the second order indicated, well, it might just be appropriate to enter fees for after January of 2005. However, the court, you know, Mr. Bruges informed this court that he was waiting for us to amend our fee petition. That is absolutely not true. In fact, the court specifically said, after indicating that it might, you know, that it would use the January 4th cutoff, he said there are still specific objections to certain charges listed on the verified claim for fees and costs. I will allow plaintiff's counsel 2 weeks from the filing of this order to put his objections in writing, and then I give the defendants 2 weeks to respond. Court wasn't waiting for anything further from us. We had provided a detailed description of every single date, every single effort that was expended from the beginning of the case until the time of the submittal. So, to the extent that the judge felt it necessary to take out any of those entries, the court had all the information already before it and was not asking for anything in addition. What happened was that Mr. Bruges then filed a petition that said we were entitled to nothing, that nothing was based upon the discovery violation, and basically attempted to re-argue the case and even made the rather amazing argument that it was somehow wrong of defendants to spend so much money on a case that was obviously worth so little. And that was in his response to the fee petition. Under the facts of that case, I think that the judge, frankly, had it. And the judge entered his last order that if you don't even want to submit reasonable objections, and the judge that he entered the final order. One thing I'd point out, Mr. Bruges takes the position that this hearing was about to see whether he paid for medical charges, and that's what the whole hearing was about. That's another complete fabrication. The motion for sanctions specifically said that there was discovery games being played and that the documents found in discovery showed that there was some kind of an arrangement between plaintiff and the doctor's office to pay the doctor's office some charges over and above what was paid by the insurance company. Now, the trial court found that there was no direct payment made to the doctor's office by Mr. Bruges' office for the medical charges that were incurred. But the court also found that he was, the day the case was filed, started talking to him about doing independent work on the file in order to get him more money. And the court said this was an unsavory sweetening of the deal from the very first day this case was filed. So the notion, and the judge also indicated before the hearing that he thought a hearing was necessary after reviewing the briefs and pleadings on this to determine what the state of mind was at that deposition. What was the good faith or non-good faith basis for these discovery violations? That's what this hearing was concerned with. Merely because the court found that there was no direct medical payments and there was an unidentified guarantor on billing sheets that to this day nobody has identified who that unidentified guarantor was, but merely because the court found that there was no direct evidence of medical payments, Mr. Bruges turns that into, oh, there was no need for this hearing. That is completely untrue. The bottom line is the judge found a lot of games played in this case, and the judge ordered what the court felt were appropriate sanctions under these very egregious circumstances. And to suggest that this was only due to two minor Rule 26 violations is, I think it flies in the face not only of what happened, not only does it misrepresent what happened, but it suggests that the trial court was somehow crazy. And that is absolutely not what happened. There were games played here. In our briefs, we address all of their technical arguments. As I mentioned already, this was not a claim one versus claim two hearing. It was one hearing for sanctions, for violations and discovery abuse. The court ruled in our favor on that motion. There was no counts one and count two. And then finally, as Your Honor has already found, I think that the argument that Rule 37 can only be assessed against the party is absolutely outrageous. For Mr. Bruges to be making that argument when all it would do is shift.
It would be outrageous if Holy and Farina had hired a new law firm to protect Mr. Wade.
Well, that's right. I'm suggesting that it's outrageous for Mr. Wade's attorney before this court to be making that argument. In summary, unless Your Honors have any other questions, the trial court, the standard here, as everybody knows, is abuse of discretion. Did the trial court abuse its discretion? And this court has already held that in order to find an abuse of discretion, you'd have to find that no reasonable jurist would agree with the trial court's sanctions, or you'd have to find that the trial court's ruling is clearly unreasonable, arbitrary, or fanciful. Now, I submit to Your Honors, this case does not meet those standards. The trial court entered what it thought were appropriate sanctions under very egregious circumstances, and we ask that that ruling be affirmed in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schur. Anything further, Mr. Bruges?
As I stated, Mr. Wade has new counsel, and Mr. Wade's new counsel participated in the Seventh Circuit settlement conference. Mr. Wade's new counsel was...
There's one brief filed in this case. It is filed by Hoey and Farina on behalf of both Wade and Bruges.
Correct. And Mr. Wade's counsel asked us to represent.
There is no listing of any counsel independent for Mr. Wade.
Okay. He participated in the Seventh Circuit. So, I mean, he has a new attorney and he asked us
of it to sign whatever it was you chose to put in the brief.
Yes, sir. Your Honors, there's two violations here, one for Exhibit H and one for Exhibit F and G. They're violations under Rule 26. I was sanctioned under Rule 37. There has been no showing that there was any attorney's fees, much less $110,000 in attorney's fees, caused by the rule violations that Judge Zagel found. Now, there was a lot of things that went on at Dr. Treister's office that I have no control over. Early on in my career, I'll give you an example. I had a young man who had about a 75% amputation of his hand and went to see a doctor by the name of Terry Light at Loyola, best hand surgeon in the world, did a 7-hour microsurgery, and the kid regained about 90%, almost 100% use of his hand. I have sent, over the last 20 years, probably 15 or 20 people who have had hand injuries to go see Dr. Terry Light because he's the best. And that's what happened here. Mike Treister was seen at the emergency room at Rush Press on two occasions. The first occasion, they injected his shoulder. The second occasion, they said, you need to see an orthopedic surgeon.
We have your position, counsel.
Mike, before you disappear, are you the one that sent him to the doctor?
No, one of the investigators in our office, when he had the...
It was your office that sent him, though.
Absolutely, Judge.
Yeah.
There was a referral from Rush Press to see an orthopedic surgeon, and we gave him the name of Dr. Treister.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.